It was not that her father was unfriendly. They never spoke of what lay between them, but Kristen could feel that in everything he left unsaid, he was steadfastly determined to stand by his refusal. And she burned with longing for his affection. Her anguish was even greater because she knew how much else her father had to bear, and if things had been as they were before, he would have talked to her about his concerns. It's true that at Urengard they were better prepared than most other places, but even here they felt the effects of the bad year, every day and every hour. In the winter, Lavrans usually spent time breaking and training his foals, but this year, during the autumn, he had sold all of them in the south. His daughter missed hearing his voice out in the courtyard and watching him tussle with the lanky, shaggy 2-year-old horses in the game that he loved so much. The storerooms, barns, and bins on the farm had not been emptied after the harvest of the previous year, but many people came to Urengard asking for help, either as a purchase or a gift, and no one asked in vain. Late one evening, a very old man, dressed in furs, arrived on skis. Lavran spoke to him out in the courtyard, and Halvdan took food to him in the hearthroom. No one on the farm who had seen him knew who he was, but it was assumed that he was one of the people who lived in the mountains. Perhaps Lavrans had run into him out there. But Kristen's father didn't speak of the visit, nor did Halvdan. Then one evening, a man arrived with whom Lavrans Bjørgulfsson had had a score to settle for many years. Lavrans went out to the storeroom with him. But when he returned to the house, he said, "Everyone wants me to help them. And yet, here on my farm, you're all against me. Even you, wife," he said angrily to Ronfrid. Then Ronfrid lashed out at Kristen. "Do you hear what your father is saying to me? I'm not against you, Lavrans. You know full well, Kristen, what happened south of here at Raldsdal late in the fall, when he traveled through the valley in the company of that other whoremonger, his kinsman from Haugen. She took her own life, that unfortunate woman he had enticed away from all her kinsmen." Her face rigid, Kristen replied harshly, "I see that you blame him as much for the years when he was striving to get out of sin as for those when he was living in it." "Jesus Maria," cried Ronfrid, clasping her hands together. "Look what's become of you. Won't even this make you change your mind?" "No," said Kristen. "I haven't changed my mind." Then Lavrans looked up from the bench where he was sitting with Ulvil.
"Nor have I, Kristen," he said quietly.
But Kristen knew in her heart that in some way she had changed. If not her decision, then her outlook. She had received word of the progress of that ill-fated journey. It had gone easier than anyone could have expected. Whether it was because the cold had settled in his wound, or for some other reason, the knife injury which Erlan had received in the chest had become infected. He lay ill at the hostel in Raldsdag for a long time, and Herr Bjørn tended to him during those days. But because Erlan had been wounded, it was easier to explain everything else and to make others believe them. When he was able to continue, he transported the dead woman in a coffin all the way to Oslo. There, with Sira Jan's intervention, he found a gravesite for her in the cemetery of Nikolaus Church, which lay in ruins. Then he had confessed to the Bishop of Oslo himself, who had enjoined him to travel to the Shrine of the Holy Blood in Schwerin. So now he had left the country. There was no place to which she could make a pilgrimage to seek redemption. Her lot was to stay here, to wait and worry and try to endure her opposition to her parents. A strange, cold winter light fell over all her memories of her meetings with Erlan. She thought about his ardor, in love and in sorrow, and it occurred to her that if she had been able to seize on all things with equal abruptness and plunge ahead at once, then afterward they might seem of less consequence and easier to bear. Sometimes the thought that Erlan might give her up, she had always had a slight fear that it could become too difficult for them, and he would lose heart. But she would not give him up.
not unless he released her from all promises. And so the winter wore on. And Kristen could no longer fool herself. She had to admit that now the most difficult trial awaited all of them, for Ulvil did not have long to live. And in the midst of her bitter sorrow over her sister, Kristen realized with horror that her own soul had been led astray and was corrupted by sin. For as she witnessed the dying child and her parents' unspeakable grief, she thought of only one thing. If Ulvil dies, how will I be able to endure facing my father without throwing myself down before him, to confess everything and to beg him to forgive me and to do with me what he will? The Lenten fast was upon them. People were slaughtering the small animals they had hoped to save before the livestock perished on its own. And people were falling ill from living on fish and the scant and wretched portions of grain. Sira Eirik released the entire village from the ban against consuming milk, but no one even had a drop of milk. Ulvild was confined to bed. She slept alone in the sister's bed, and someone watched over her every night. Sometimes Kristen and her father would both sit with her. On one such night, Lavrán said to his daughter, "Do you remember what Brother Edvin said about Ulvil's fate? I thought at the time that maybe this was what he meant, but I put it out of my mind." During those nights, he would occasionally talk about one thing or another from the time when the children were small. Kristen would sit there, pale and miserable, understanding that behind his words, her father was pleading with her. One day Lavrans had gone out with Kolbein to seek out a bear's lair in the mountain forest to the north. They returned home with a female bear on a sled, and Lavrans was carrying a little bear cub, still alive, inside his tunic. Ulvild smiled a little when he showed it to her. But Ronfrid said that this was no time to take in that kind of animal. And what was he going to do with it now?
"I'm going to fatten it up and then tie it to the bedchamber of my maidens," said Lavrans, laughing harshly.
But they couldn't find the kind of rich milk that the bear cub needed. And so several days later, Lavrans killed it. The sun had grown so strong that occasionally, in the middle of the day, the eaves would begin to drip. The titmice clung to the timbered walls and hopped around on the sunny side. The pecking of their beaks resounded as they looked for flies asleep in the gaps between the wood. Out across the meadows the snow gleamed, hard and shiny like silver. Finally, one evening, clouds began to gather in front of the moon. In the morning, they woke up at Urengard to a whirl of snow that blocked their view in all directions. On that day, it became clear that Ulvild was going to die. The entire household had gathered inside, and Sira Eirik had come. Many candles were burning in the room. Early that evening, Ulvild passed on, calmly and peacefully, in her mother's arms. Ronfrid bore it better than anyone could have expected. The parents sat together, both of them weeping softly. Everyone in the room was crying. When Kristen went over to her father, he put his arm around her shoulders. He noticed how she was trembling and shaking, and then he pulled her close. But it seemed to her that he must have felt as if she had been snatched farther away from him than her dead little sister in the bed. She didn't know how she had managed to endure. She hardly remembered why she was enduring, but, lethargic and mute with pain, she managed to stay on her feet and did not collapse. Then a couple of planks were pulled up in the floor in front of the altar of St. Thomas, and a grave was dug in the rock-hard earth underneath for Ulvild Lavransdottir. It snowed heavily and silently for all those days the child lay on the straw bier. It was snowing as she was laid in the earth, and it continued to snow, almost without stop, for an entire month. For those who were waiting for the redemption of spring, it seemed as if it would never come. The days grew long and bright, and the valley lay in a haze of thawing snow while the sun shone. But frost was still in the air, and the heat had no power. At night it froze hard. Great cracking sounds came from the ice. A rumbling issued from the mountains, and the wolves howled and the foxes yipped all the way down in the village, as if it were midwinter. People scraped off bark for the livestock, but they were perishing by the dozens in their stalls. No one knew when it would end. Kristen went out on such a day, when the water was trickling in the furrows of the road, and the snow glistened like silver across the fields. Facing the sun, the snowdrifts had become hollowed out so that the delicate ice lattice of the crusted snow broke with the gentle ring of silver when she pressed her foot against it. But wherever there was the slightest shadow, the air was sharp with frost, and the snow was hard. She walked up toward the church. She didn't know why she was going there, but she felt drawn to it. Her father was there. Several farmers, guild brothers, were holding a meeting in the gallery, that much she knew. Up on the hill she met the group of farmers as they were leaving. Sira Eirik was with them. The men were all on foot, walking in a dark, fur-wrapped cluster, nodding and talking to each other. They returned her greeting in a surly manner as she passed. Kristen thought to herself that it had been a long time since everyone in the village had been her friend. Everyone no doubt knew that she was a bad daughter. Perhaps they knew even more about her. Now they probably all thought that there must have been some truth to the old gossip about her and Arna and Bentine. Perhaps she was in terrible disrepute. She lifted her chin and walked on toward the church. The door stood ajar. It was cold inside the church, and yet a certain warmth streamed toward her from this dim brown room, with the tall columns soaring upward, lifting the darkness up toward the crossbeams of the roof. There were no lit candles on the altars, but a little sunshine came in through the open door, casting a faint light on the paintings and vessels. Up near the St. Thomas altar, she saw her father on his knees, with his head resting on his folded hands, which were clutching his cap against his knees. Shy and dispirited, Kristen tiptoed out and stood on the gallery. Framed by the arch of two small pillars, which she held on to, she saw Jurengard lying below, and beyond her home the pale blue haze over the valley. In the sun, the river glinted white with water and ice all through the village. But the alder thicket along its bank was golden brown with blossoms. The spruce forest was spring green even up by the church, and tiny birds chittered and chirped and trilled in the grove nearby. Oh yes, she had heard birdsong like that every evening after the sun set. And now she felt the longing that she thought had been wrung out of her, the longing in her body and in her blood. It began to stir now, feeble and faint, as if it were waking up from a winter's hibernation. Lavrans Björgolfsson came outside and closed the church door behind him. He went over and stood near his daughter, looking out from the next arch. She noticed how the winter had ravaged her father. She didn't think that she could bring this up now, but it tumbled out of her all the same. "Is it true what Mother said the other day? That you told her, if it had been Arne Geirdsson, then you would have relented?"
"Yes," said Lavrans without looking at her.
"You never said that while Arna was alive," replied Kristen.
"It was never discussed. I could see that the boy was fond of you, but he said nothing. And he was young. And I never noticed that you thought of him in that way. You couldn't expect me to offer my daughter to a man who owned no property."
He smiled fleetingly.
"But I was fond of the boy," he said softly. "And if I had seen that you were pining with love for him..."
They remained standing there, staring straight ahead. Kristen sensed her father looking at her. She struggled to keep her expression calm, but she could feel how pale she was. Then her father came over to her, put both arms around her, and hugged her tight. He tilted her head back, looked into his daughter's face, and then hid it against his shoulder.
"Jesus Christus, little Kristen. Are you so unhappy?
I think I'm going to die from it, Father, she said against his chest.
She burst into tears. But she was crying because she had felt in his caress and seen in his eyes that now he was so worn out with anguish that he could no longer hold on to his opposition. She had won. In the middle of the night, she woke up when her father touched her shoulder in the dark.
Get up, he said quietly. Do you hear it?
Then she heard the singing at the corners of the house, the deep, full tone of the moisture-laden south wind. Water was streaming off the roof, and the rain whispered as it fell on soft, melting snow. Kristen threw on a dress and followed her father to the outer door. Together they stood and looked out into the bright May night. Warm wind and rain swept toward them. The sky was a heap of tangled, surging rain clouds. There was a seething from the woods, a whistling between the buildings. And up on the mountains they heard the hollow rumble of snow sliding down. Kristen reached for her father's hand and held it. He had called her and wanted to show her this. It was the kind of thing he would have done in the past, before things changed between them. And now he was doing it again. When they went back inside to lie down, Lavran said,
The stranger who was here this week carried a letter to me from Sir Munon Bardson. He intends to come here this summer to visit his mother, and he asked whether he might seek me out and speak with me.
How will you answer him, my father? She whispered.
I can't tell you that now, replied Lavrans. But I will speak to him, and then I must act in such a way that I can answer for myself before God, my daughter.
Kristen crawled into bed beside Romborg, and Lavrans went over and lay down next to his sleeping wife. He lay there, thinking that if the flood waters rose high and suddenly, then few farms in the village would be as vulnerable as Urengard. There was supposed to be a prophecy about it, that one day the river would take the farm. Chapter 5 Spring arrived abruptly. Several days after the frost broke, the village lay brown and black beneath the torrents of rain. Water rushed down the mountain slopes, and the river swelled and lay like a leaden gray lake at the bottom of the valley, with small flooded groves at the edge of the water and a sly gurgling furrow of current. At Urengard, the water reached far into the fields, and yet everywhere the damage was much less than people had feared. The spring farm work was late that year, and everyone sowed their sparse seeds with prayers to God that he might spare them from the night frost until harvest time. And it looked as if he would heed their prayers and lighten their burden a little. June came with favorable weather, the summer was good, and everyone began to hope that in time, the traces of the bad year would be erased. The hay harvesting was over when one evening, four men came riding toward Urengard. Two gentlemen and their two servants, Sir Munon Bardson and Sir Bard Pedersen of Hesnes. Ronfrid and Lavrans ordered the table to be set in the high loft, and beds to be made up in the loft above the storehouse. But Lavrans asked the gentlemen to wait to set forth their purpose until the following day, after they had rested from their journey. Sir Munon did most of the talking during the meal, directing much of the conversation toward Kristen, speaking to her as if they were well acquainted. She noticed that her father was not pleased by this. Sir Munon was thick-set, with a ruddy face, an ugly and garrulous man with a rather foolish manner. People called him Munon the Stump or Munon the Prancer. But in spite of the impression he made, Fru Asild's son was still a sensible and capable man who had been the crown's envoy in several matters and who doubtless had some influence on those who counseled the governance of the kingdom. He lived on his mother's ancestral property in the Skogheim district. He was quite wealthy, and he had made a rich marriage. Fru Katrin, his wife, was peculiarly ugly, and she seldom opened her mouth, but her husband always spoke of her as if she were the wisest of women. In jest, people called Fru Katrin
the resourceful woman with the lovely voice. They seemed to get on well together and treated each other with affection, even though Sir Munan was notorious for his wayward behavior, both before and after his marriage. Sir Bard Peterson was a handsome and stately old man, although he was rather portly and heavy of limb. His hair and beard were somewhat faded now, but there was still as much gold in them as there was white. Ever since the death of King Magnus Håkonsson, he had lived quietly, managing his vast properties at Nordmøre. He was a widower after the death of his second wife, and he had many children, who were all said to be handsome, well-mannered, and well-to-do. The following day, Lavrans and his guests went up to the loft to talk. Lavrans asked his wife to join them, but she refused.
"This must lie solely in your hands," said Ronfrid. "You know that it would be the greatest sorrow for our daughter if this matter could not be resolved.
But I see that there is much to be said against this marriage."
Sir Munan presented a letter from Erlan Nikolausen. Erlan proposed that Lavrans should decide on all of the conditions if he would agree to the betrothal of his daughter Kristen. Erlan himself was willing to have his properties appraised and his income examined by impartial men, and to offer Kristen such betrothal and wedding gifts that she would own a third of his possessions, in addition to whatever she brought to the marriage itself, and all inheritances that she might acquire from her kinsmen if she should become a widow with no children surviving the father. Furthermore, he offered to allow Kristen to manage with full authority her part of the property, both that which she brought into the marriage and that which she was given by him. But if Lavrans preferred other conditions for the division of property, then Erlan would be willing to hear his views and to act accordingly. There was only one condition to which Kristen's kinsmen would have to bind themselves. If they acquired guardianship over any children that he and she might have, they must never try to revoke the gifts that he had given to his children by Elina Orm's daughter. They must recognize as valid the claim that these properties had been separated from his possessions before he entered into the marriage with Kristen Lavrans' daughter. Finally, Erland offered to hold the wedding with all appropriate splendor at his manor at Husaby. It was then Lavrans' turn to speak, and he said,
"This is a handsome offer. I see that it is your kinsman's fervent desire to come to an agreement with me. I also realize that he has asked you, Sir Munan, for a second time to come on such an errand to me, a man of no great import outside this village, and a gentleman such as you, Sir Bard, to take the trouble to make this journey on his behalf. But now I must tell you, in regard to Erlon's offer, that my daughter has not been raised to manage properties and riches herself, and I have always intended to give her to a man in whose hands I could confidently place the maiden's welfare. I don't know whether Kristen is capable of handling such responsibility or not, but I hardly think that she would thrive by doing so. She is placid and compliant in temperament. One of the reasons that I bore in mind when I opposed the marriage was this, that Erlan has shown a certain imprudence in several areas. Had she been a domineering, bold, and headstrong woman, then the situation would have been quite different."
Sir Munan burst out laughing and said,
"My dear Lavrans, are you complaining that the maiden is not headstrong enough?" And Sir Bard said with a little smile, "It seems to me that your daughter has demonstrated that she is not lacking in will. For 2 years she had stood by Erlan, in spite of your wishes."
Lavran said, "I know that quite well, and yet I know what I'm talking about. It has been hard for her during the time she has defied me, and she won't be happy with a husband for long unless he can rule her."
"The devil take me," said Sir Munan. "Then your daughter must be quite unlike all the women I have known, for I've never found a single one who didn't prefer to rule over both herself and her husband."
Lavrans shrugged his shoulders and didn't reply. Then Bard Peterson said,
"I can imagine, Lavrans Bjørgulfsson, that now you are even less in favor of this marriage between your daughter and my foster son, since the woman he was with came to such an end.
but you should know that it has now come to light that the wretched woman had let herself be seduced by another man, the foreman of Erlan's farm at Husaby. Erlan knew about this when he journeyed with her through the valley. He had offered to provide her with a proper dowry if the man would marry her.
Are you sure this is true? Asked Lavrans.
And yet, I don't know whether it makes the situation any better. It must be bitter for a woman of good family to arrive on the arm of the landowner, only to leave with the farmhand.
Munan Bardson put in,
I see, Lavrans Bjørgovsson, that your strongest objection to my cousin is that he has had this unfortunate trouble with Sigurd Saxulfsson's wife. And it's true that it was ill-advised. But in the name of God, man, you must remember. There he was, a young boy in the same house with a young and beautiful wife, and she had a cold and useless old husband, and the nights last half the year up there. I don't think much else could have been expected, unless Erlan had actually been a holy man. It can't be denied that Erlan has never had any monk flesh in him, but I don't imagine that your lovely young daughter would be grateful if you gave her to a monk. It's true that Erlan conducted himself foolishly, and even worse later on. But this matter must finally be considered closed. We, his kinsmen, have striven to help set the boy on his feet again. The woman is dead, and Erlan has done everything within his power for her body and soul. The Bishop of Oslo himself has redeemed him from his sin, and now he has come home, cleansed by the holy blood in Schwerin. Do you intend to be harsher than the Bishop of Oslo, and the Archbishop, or whoever it is down there who presides over the precious blood? My dear Lavrans, it's true that pure living is an admirable thing. But it's hardly within the powers of a grown man unless he is particularly blessed by God. By Saint Olaf, you should keep in mind that the Holy King himself was not given that blessing until the end of his life on earth. It was evidently God's will that he should first produce the capable boy King Magnus, who repelled the heathen's invasion of the north. King Olaf did not have that son by his queen, and yet he sits among the highest of saints in heaven. Yes, I can see that you think this improper talk, Sir Bard interrupted. Lavrans Bjørgovsson, I didn't like this matter any better than you when Erlan first came to me and said that he had set his heart on a maiden who was betrothed. But I have since realized that there is such a strong love between these two young people, it would be a great sin to separate their affections. Erlan was with me at the Christmas feast that King Håkon held for his men. That's where they met, and as soon as they saw each other, your daughter fainted and lay as if dead for a long time. And I could see that my foster son would rather lose his own life than lose her.
Lavran sat in silence for a moment before he replied.
Yes, that sort of thing sounds so beautiful when we hear it in a courtly tale from the southern lands. But we are not in Bretland, and surely you would demand more of a man you intend to take as a son-in-law than that he had made your daughter swoon with love before everyone's eyes.
The other two didn't speak, and then Lavrans continued.
I think, good sirs, that if Erlan Nicolason had not so greatly diminished both his property and his reputation, then you would not be sitting here asking so earnestly for a man of my circumstances to give my daughter to him. But I won't have it said about Kristin that she was honored by coming to Husaby through marriage to a man belonging to this country's best lineage, after that man had disgraced himself so badly that he could neither expect a better match nor maintain his family's distinction.
He stood up abruptly and paced back and forth across the floor.
But Sir Munan jumped up. No, Lavrans. If you're going to talk about bringing shame upon oneself, then by God, you should know that you're being much too proud.
Sir Bard cut him off. He went over to Lavrans and said,
And proud you are, Lavrans. You're like those landowners in the past we've heard about, who refused to accept titles from the kings because their sense of pride could not tolerate hearing people say that they owed anything to anyone but themselves.
I must tell you that if Erlan had possessed all the honor and wealth that the boy was born with, I would still not consider it disparaging to myself when I asked a man of good lineage and good circumstances to give his daughter to my foster son, if I could see that it would break the hearts of these two young people to be kept apart. Especially, he said softly, placing his hand on the other man's shoulder, if things were such that it was best for the health of both their souls if they were allowed to marry.
Lavrans shook off Bard's hand. His face grew stony and cold.
I don't know what you mean, sir.
The two men looked at each other for a moment. Then Sir Bard said,
I mean that Erlan has told me that they have sworn themselves to each other with the most solemn of oaths. Perhaps you think you have the authority to release your child, since she has sworn without your consent. But you cannot release Erlan. And I can't see that there is anything standing in the way except your pride and your abhorrence of sin. But in this it seems to me that you wish to be harsher than God himself, Lavrans Björgofsson.
Lavrans answered somewhat uncertainly.
You may be right in what you say, Sir Bard. But I have mainly opposed this marriage because Erland seemed to me an unreliable man to whom I would not want to entrust my daughter. I think I can vouch for my foster son now, said Bard in a subdued tone of voice. He loves Kristen so much that if you give her to him, I am convinced he will conduct himself in such a manner that you will have no cause to complain of your son-in-law.
Lavrans didn't reply at once. Then Sir Bard said imploringly, holding out his hand,
In God's name, Lavrans Björgofsson, give your consent.
Lavrans gave his hand to Sir Bard.
In God's name.
Ronfrid and Kristen were called to the loft, and Lavrans told them of his decision. Sir Bard graciously greeted the two women. Sir Munon shook Ronfrid's hand and spoke courteously to her, but he greeted Kristen in the foreign manner with kisses, and he took his time about it. Kristen noticed that her father was looking at her as he did this.
How do you like your new kinsman, Sir Munon?
He asked with derision when he was alone with her for a moment that evening. Kristen gave her father an imploring look. Then he stroked her face several times and said nothing more. When Sir Bard and Sir Munon had gone to bed, the latter said,
What wouldn't I give to see the face of this Lavrans Björgofsson if he ever learned the truth about his precious daughter? Here you and I had to beg on our knees for Erlan to win a woman as his wife, whom he has had with him up at Brynhild's Inn so many times. You keep quiet about that, replied Sir Bard bitterly. It was the worst thing Erlan could have done when he enticed the child to such a place. And never let Lavrans get word of this. It will be best for everyone if those two can be friends.
It was agreed that the betrothal celebration would be held that same autumn. Lavrans said that he could not offer a grand banquet because the previous year had been so bad in the valley. But he would, on the other hand, host the wedding and hold it at Urengard with all appropriate splendor. He mentioned again the bad year as his reason for demanding that the betrothal period should last a year. Chapter 6 The betrothal celebration was postponed for various reasons. It didn't take place until the new year. But Lavrans agreed that the wedding needn't be delayed because of that. It would be held immediately following Michaelmas, as had been originally agreed. So Kristen continued to live at Urengard as Erlan's properly acknowledged betrothed. Along with her mother, she went over the dowry that had been assembled for her and strove to add even more to the piles of bed linen and clothing, for Lavrans wanted nothing to be spared, now that he had given his daughter to the master of Husaby. Kristen was surprised that she didn't feel happier. But in spite of all the activity, there was no real joy at Urengard. Her parents missed Ulvil deeply, she knew that. But she also realized that this was not the only reason they were so silent and somber.
They were kind to her, but when they spoke of her betrothed, she could see that they had to force themselves to do so. And they did it to please her and to be kind. They did not do it out of any desire to speak of Erlon themselves. They were not any happier about the husband she had chosen now that they had come to know the man. Erlond was also silent and reserved during the brief time he was at Urengard for the betrothal celebration, and it could not have been any other way, thought Kristen. He knew that her father had only reluctantly given his consent. Even she and Erlond had hardly exchanged more than a few words alone. And it had been awkward and strange for them to sit together in full view of everyone. They had had little to talk about because they had shared so many secrets. A slight fear began to stir inside her, faint and dim, but always present, that perhaps, in some way, it might be difficult for them when they were finally married, because they had been too close to each other in the beginning, and then had been separated for far too long. But she tried to push this thought aside. Erlon was supposed to stay with them at Urengard during Whitsuntide. He had asked Lavrans and Ronfrid whether they would have any objections if he came to visit, and Lavrans had hesitated a moment, but then replied that he would welcome his son-in-law. Erland could be assured of that. During Whitsuntide, they would be able to take walks together, and they would talk as they had in the old days. Then it would surely go away, this shadow that had come between them during the long separation, when they had each struggled and borne everything alone. At Easter, Simon Andresen and his wife were at Formo. Kristen saw them in church. Simon's wife was standing quite close to her. She must be much older than he is, thought Kristen. Almost 30. Fru Hofrid was short and delicate and thin, but she had an unusually lovely face. Even the pale brown color of her hair, which billowed from under her wimple, seemed so gentle, and her eyes were full of gentleness too. They were large and gray with a sprinkling of tiny glints of gold. Every line of her face was fine and pure, but her complexion was a pale gray, and when she opened her mouth, it was apparent that she did not have good teeth. She didn't look strong, and she was also said to be sickly. Kristen had heard that she had already miscarried several times. She wondered how Simon felt about this wife. The people from Urengard and from Formo had greeted each other across the church hill several times, though they had not spoken. But on the third day, Simon came to church without his wife. Then he came over to Lavrans, and they talked together for a while. Kristen heard them mention Ulvil. Afterward, he spoke to Ronfrid. Romborg, who was with her mother, said quite loudly,
"I remember you. I know who you are."
Simon lifted up the child and swung her around.
"It was nice of you not to forget me, Romborg."
Kristen he greeted only from a short distance away. And her parents didn't mention the meeting again. But Kristen thought a great deal about it. It had been strange to see Simon Dara as a married man. So many things from the past came alive once more. She remembered her own blind and submissive love for Erlon back then. Now it was somehow different. She wondered whether Simon had told his wife how the two of them had parted. But she knew that he wouldn't have done that. "For my father's sake," she thought with derision. She felt so oddly destitute to be still unmarried and living at home with her parents. But they were betrothed. Simon could see that they had forced their will through. Whatever else Erlan might have done, he had remained faithful to her, and she had been neither reckless nor frivolous. One evening in early spring, Ronfrid wanted to send a message south to old Gunhill, the widow who sewed fur pelts. The evening was so beautiful that Kristen asked if she could go. In the end, she was given permission because all the men were busy. It was after sunset, and a fine white frosty mist rose up toward the golden green sky. With every hoofbeat, Kristen heard the brittle sound of evening ice as it shattered and then dispersed with a rattling sound. But in the twilight, from the thickets along the road, came a jubilant bird song, soft and full of spring. Kristen rode briskly down the road without thinking about much of anything, simply feeling how good it was to be outside alone. She rode with her gaze fixed on the new moon, which was about to sink behind the mountain ridge on the other side of the valley. She almost fell off her horse when the animal abruptly swerved to the side and then reared up. She saw a dark body curled up at the edge of the road. At first she was afraid. The dire fear of meeting someone alone out on the road never left her. But she thought it might be a wanderer who had fallen ill. So when she had regained control of her horse, she turned around and rode back as she called out, "Is anyone there?" The bundle stirred a bit, and a voice said,
"I think it must be you, Kristen Lovren's daughter."
"Brother Edvin?" she asked softly. She almost thought it was a phantom or some kind of deviltry that was trying to fool her. But she went over to him, and it was the old man after all, but he couldn't get up without help.
"My dear father, are you out here wandering at this time of year?" she asked in astonishment.
"Praise be to God for sending you this way tonight," said the monk.
Kristen noticed that he was shivering all over.
"I was on my way north to visit you, but I could go no farther tonight. I almost thought it was God's will that I should lie here and die on the roads where I've roamed and slept all my life. But I would have liked to receive absolution and the last rites. And I wanted to see you again, my daughter."
Kristen helped the monk up onto her horse and then led it by the bridle as she supported him. In between his protests that she was getting her feet wet in the icy slush, he moaned softly in pain. He told her that he had been at Eabu since Christmas. Some wealthy farmers in the village had promised during the bad year to furnish their church with new adornments, but his work had gone slowly. He had been ill during the winter. There was something wrong with his stomach that made him vomit blood, and he couldn't tolerate food. He didn't think he had long to live, so he was headed home to his cloister. He wanted to die there, among his brothers. But he had set his mind on coming north through the valley one last time, and so he had accompanied the monk from Hamar when he traveled north to become the new resident priest at the Pilgrim Hostel in Roldstad. From Frome, he had gone on alone.
"I heard that you were betrothed," he said, "to that man. And then I had such a yearning to see you. I felt so anguished that our meeting in the church at the cloister should be our last. It's been weighing so heavy on my heart, Kristen, that you had strayed from the path of peace."
Kristen kissed the monk's hand and said,
"I don't understand, Father, what I have done to deserve your willingness to show me such great love."
The monk replied quietly,
"I have often thought, Kristen, that if it had been possible for us to meet more often, you might have become my spiritual daughter."
"Do you mean you would have guided me so that I turned my heart to the convent life?" asked Kristen.
After a pause, she went on, "Sira Eirik impressed on me that if I couldn't win my father's consent to marry Erlon, then I would have to enter a holy sisterhood and do penance for my sins."
"I have often prayed that you might have a yearning for the convent life," said Brother Edvin, "but not since you told me what you know. I wish that you could have come to God with your wreath, Kristen."
When they reached Urengard, Brother Edvin had to be carried inside and put to bed. They put him in the old winter house, in the hearth room, and made him as comfortable as they could. He was very ill, and Sira Eirik came and tended to him with medicaments for his body and soul. But the priest said that the old man was suffering from cancer, and that he didn't have long to live. Brother Edvin himself thought that when he had regained some of his strength, he would head south again and try to make it back to his cloister. Sira Eirik told the others that he didn't believe this was likely. Everyone at Urengard felt that great peace and joy had come to them with the monk. People went in and out of the hearth room all day long, and it was never difficult to find someone willing to keep vigil over the sick man at night. They flocked around him, as many as could find the time to sit and listen when Sira Eirik came and read to the dying man from the holy books,
and they talked with Brother Edvin about spiritual matters. And even though much of what he said was vague and obscure, as was his manner of speaking, the people seemed to draw strength and comfort for their souls, because everyone could see that Brother Edvin was filled with his love for God. But the monk also wanted to hear about everything else. He asked for news from the villages and wanted Lavrans to tell him about the bad year. Some people had seized upon evil counsel in that time of adversity and had sought out the sort of help that Christian men must shun. A short way into the mountains west of the valley, there was a place with great white stones that were shaped like the secret parts of human beings, and some men had fallen to sacrificing boars and cats before this monstrosity. Sira Eirik had then taken several of the most pious and brave of the farmers out there one night, and they had smashed the stones flat. Lavrans had gone along and could testify that they were completely smeared with blood, and there were bones and the like lying all around. Up in Heidel, people had apparently made an old woman sit outside on a buried stone and recite ancient incantations on three Thursday nights in a row. One night, Kristen was sitting alone with Brother Edvin. Around midnight, he woke up and seemed to be suffering great pain. Then he asked Kristen to read to him from the book about the miracles of the Virgin Mary, which Sira Eirik had lent to him. Kristen wasn't used to reading aloud, but she sat down on the step of the bed and put the candle next to her. She placed the book on her knees and read as best she could. After a while, she noticed that the sick man was lying in bed with his teeth clamped tight, and he had clenched his emaciated hands into fists from the pain. "You're suffering badly, dear father," said Kristen with dismay.
"It seems that way to me now. But I know it's because God has made me into a child again and is tossing me up and down. I remember a time when I was small. I was 4 winters old, and I ran away from home and headed into the forest. I got lost and was out there for many days and nights. My mother was with the people who found me, and when she lifted me up into her arms, I remember that she bit me on the back of the neck. I thought it was because she was angry with me, but later I understood otherwise. Now I'm longing for home, away from this forest. It is written, 'Forsake all things and follow me.' But there has been far too much here in this world that I didn't have the heart to forsake."
"You, father?" said Kristen. "I've always heard everyone say that you were a model of pure living and poverty and humility."
The monk chuckled. "Ah, young child, you probably think there's nothing else that entices in the world save sensual pleasure and wealth and power. I must tell you that these are small things that are found along the side of the road. But I have loved the roads themselves. It was not the small things of the world that I loved, but the entire world. God, in his mercy, allowed me to love Sister Poverty and Sister Celibacy, even in my youth. And that was why I thought that with these lay sisters I could walk in safety. And so I have wandered and roamed, wishing that I could travel all the roads of the world. And my heart and my thoughts have wandered and roamed too. I fear that I have often gone astray in my thoughts about the darkest of things. But now that's over, little Kristen. Now I want to go back to my home and put aside all my own thoughts and listen to the clear words of the guardian about what I should believe, and think about my sins and about God's mercy."
A little while later, he fell asleep. Kristen sat down near the hearth and tended the fire. But toward morning, when she was also about to doze off, Brother Edvin suddenly said to her from the bed,
"I'm glad, Kristen, that this matter between Erland Nikolausen and you has come to a good end."
Then Kristen burst into tears.
"We have done so much wrong to come this far. And worst of all is this gnawing at my heart that I have caused my father such great sorrow. He's not happy about this either. And yet he doesn't know. If he knew everything, then he would surely withdraw all his affection from me."
"Kristen,"
said Brother Edwin gently.
Don't you understand, child, that this is why you must never tell him, and why you must not cause him any more sorrow? Because he would never demand penance from you. Nothing you do could ever change your father's heart toward you.
A few days later, Brother Edwin was feeling so much better that he wanted to head south. Since he had set his heart on this, Lavrans had a kind of stretcher made that was hung between two horses, and in this manner he carried the sick man as far south as Lidstadt. There, Brother Edwin was given new horses and a new escort, and in this way he was taken as far as Hamar. There he died in the monastery of the Dominican Brothers and was buried in their church. Later, the barefoot friars demanded that the body be delivered to them, because many people in the villages considered him a holy man and called him Saint Evan. The farmers in the outlying districts and valleys as far north as Nidaros prayed to him. And thus there was a long dispute between the two cloisters over his body. Kristen didn't hear of this until much later, but she grieved deeply when she parted with the monk. It seemed to her that he alone knew her whole life. He had known the foolish child that she had been under her father's care, and he had known of her secret life with Erlon. So he was like a clasp, she thought, which bound everything she had loved to all that now filled her heart. She was now quite cut off from the person she had been, the time when she was a maiden. Chapter 7. As she tested the lukewarm brew in the vats, Ronfrid said,
I think it's cool enough that we can put in the yeast.
Kristen had been sitting inside the brewhouse door, spinning, while she waited for the liquid to cool. She set the spindle on the doorstep, unwrapped the blanket from around the bucket with the dissolved yeast, and measured out a portion.
Shut the door first, said her mother, so there won't be any draft. You're acting as if you're asleep, Kristen, she added, annoyed.
Kristen slowly poured the yeast into the brewing vats as Ronfrid stirred. Gerhild Driv's daughter invoked the name of Hot, but it was Odin who came and helped her with the brewing. In return, he demanded what was between her and the vat. This was a saga that Lavrans had once told Kristen when she was little. What was between her and the vat? Kristen felt ill and dizzy from the heat and the sweet, spicy steam in the dark, close brewhouse. Out in the courtyard, Romborg was dancing in a circle with a group of children and singing,
The eagle sits in the highest hall, flexing his golden claw.
Kristen followed her mother out to the little entryway, which was filled with empty ale kegs and all kinds of implements. From there, a door led out to a strip of ground between the back wall of the brewhouse and the fence surrounding the barley field. A swarm of pigs jostled each other, biting and squealing as they fought over the tepid, discarded mash. Kristen shaded her eyes with her hand from the glaring noonday sun. Her mother glanced at the scuffling pigs and said,
We won't be able to get by with fewer than 18 reindeer.
Do you think we'll need so many? Asked her daughter, distracted.
Yes, we must serve game with the pork each day, replied her mother. And we'll only have enough fowl and hare to serve the guests in the high loft. You must remember that close to 200 people will be coming here, with their servants and children, and the poor must be fed as well. And even though you and Erlon will leave on the fifth day, some of the guests will no doubt stay on for the rest of the week, at least. Stay here and tend to the ale, Kristen, said Ronfrid. I have to go and cook dinner for your father and the haymakers.
Kristen went to get her spinning and then sat down in the back doorway. She tucked the distaff with the wool under her arm, but her hands sank into her lap, holding the spindle. Beyond the fence, the tips of the barley glinted like silver and silk in the sun. Above the rush of the river, she heard now and then the sound of the scythes in the meadows out on the islet. Occasionally the iron would strike against stone. Her father and the servants were working hard to put the worst of the mowing season behind them. There was so much to do for her wedding.
the smell of the tepid mash and the rank breath of the pigs. She suddenly felt nauseated again, and the noontime heat made her so faint and weak. White-faced, her spine rigid, she sat there waiting for the sensation to pass. She didn't want to be sick again. She had never felt this way before. It would do no good for her to try to console herself with the thought that it wasn't yet certain, that she might be mistaken. What was between her and the vat? 18 reindeer. Close to 200 wedding guests. People would have something to laugh about then, when they heard that all the commotion was for the sake of a pregnant woman who had to be married off in time. Oh no. She tossed aside her spinning and leaped to her feet. With her forehead pressed against the wall of the brewhouse, she vomited into the thicket of nettles that grew in abundance there. Brown caterpillars were swarming over the nettles. The sight of them made her feel even sicker. Kristen rubbed her temples, wet with sweat. Oh no, surely that was enough. They were going to be married on the second Sunday after Michaelmas, and then their wedding would be celebrated for 5 days. That was more than 2 months away. By then, her mother and the other women of the village would be able to see it. They were always so wise about such matters. They could always tell when a woman was with child months before Kristen could see how they knew. Poor thing, she has grown so pale. Impatiently, Kristen rubbed her hands against her cheeks, for she could feel that they were wan and bloodless. In the past, she had so often thought that this was bound to happen one day, and she had not been terribly afraid of it. But it wouldn't have been the same back then, when they could not and would not be allowed to marry in the proper fashion. It was considered... Yes, it was thought to be shameful in many ways, and a sin too. But if it was a matter of two young people who refused to be forced from each other, that was something everyone would remember, and they would speak of the two with compassion. She would not have been ashamed. But when it happened to those who were betrothed, then everyone merely laughed and teased them mercilessly. She realized herself that it was laughable. Here they were brewing ale and making wine, slaughtering and baking and cooking for a wedding that would be talked about far and wide. And she, the bride, felt ill at the mere smell of food and crept behind the outbuildings in a cold sweat to throw up. Erlon. She clenched her teeth in anger. He should have spared her this. She had not been willing. He should have remembered how it had been before, when everything had been uncertain for her, when she had had nothing to hold on to except his love. Then she had always, always gladly yielded to his wishes. He should have left her alone this time, when she tried to refuse because she thought it improper for them to steal something in secret after her father had placed their hands together in the sight of all their kinsmen. But he had taken her, partly by force, but with laughter and with caresses too, so she had been unable to show him that she was serious in her refusal. Kristen went inside to tend to the ale, and then came back and stood leaning over the fence. The grain swayed faintly, glinting in the light breeze. She couldn't remember ever seeing the crop so dense and lush as this year. She caught a glimpse of the river in the distance, and she heard her father's voice shouting. She couldn't distinguish his words, but the workers out on the islet were laughing. What if she went to her father and told him? It would be better to forego all this trouble, to marry her to Erlon quietly, without a church wedding and grand feast, now that it was a matter of her acquiring a wife's name before it became apparent to everyone that she was already carrying Erlon's child. Erlon would be ridiculed too, just as much as she would be, or more. He was not a young boy after all. But he was the one who wanted this wedding. He wanted to see her as a bride wearing silk and velvet and a high golden crown. He wanted that. But he also wanted to possess her during all those sweet secret hours. She had acquiesced to everything. She would continue to do as he wanted in this matter too. And in the end, no doubt, he would realize that no one could have both. he who had talked of the great Christmas celebration he would hold at Husaby during the first year she was his wife on the manor. Then he would show all his kinsmen and friends and the people of the villages far and wide what a beautiful wife he had won. Kristen smiled spitefully. Christmas this year would hardly be a fitting occasion for that. It would happen around St. Gregor's Day.